I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. We are going to start with a conversation about harassment. Massive cultural changes are sweeping through American workplaces since news broke about the predatory behavior of Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein. It's not an exaggeration to say we are in the middle of a reckoning. But how to puzzle through it and what comes next? Those are harder questions to answer. So we brought on three thoughtful experts: Lily Loofborough, culture critic for The Week; Susan Marquis, dean of the Pardee Rand Graduate School and the author of I Am Not a Tractor; and David Lewis, CEO of Operations, Inc. and an HR consultant. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
David, I'm actually going to start with you because you are in HR. What are HR departments thinking about right now as we look toward this new year?
Right now, HR organizations for some companies are trying to figure out how to get leadership behind them and be supportive of their initiatives and their recommendations. I think in other HR organizations, they're trying to ensure that they're not the ones that get mentioned in the news the next time. So they're going to leadership and emphasizing the importance of training, of best practices, and of ensuring that the culture in their organization is not one that supports hostile work environment.
You know, Lily, you wrote about a bunch of different things. And one thing you wrote about here was this sort of gray area of how do we figure out what punishment fits what behavior? Is there some gradient of behavior that we are talking about, or is it all rooted in the same culture, or both?
You know, I mean, Matt Damon isn't the first to suggest that we should probably come up with some kind of hierarchy of harm. Michelle Goldberg did it at the New York Times. I've done it too. You know, the reason we need that isn't just to safeguard the reputations of men, but it's also that we've naturalized harassment in this culture to a certain extent, and we need to denaturalize it and name behaviors that we've long turned a blind eye to. Since Anita Hill testified against Clarence Thomas in 1991, and women realized that A, there was a name for what they'd experienced, and B, it was possible to make it stop, reports of sexual harassment increased and kept increasing. And that's not because women are telling fake stories. It's because they don't have to put up with it anymore. And applying that lesson to the present, it seems clear to me that sexual harassment is too broad an umbrella. You know, that story about the Eskimos having 50 words for snow is apocryphal, but it's relevant here. A culture needs a language that's rich enough to precisely describe its environment. And it's clear that for ours, sexual harassment is way too broad. We need more precision.
When we think about precision, though, we're also thinking about sort of, I hate to use the word punishment, but it is punishment, but then also solutions. I mean, Susan, you have written this book, I Am Not a Tractor, that talks about how female farm workers sort of organized and combated harassment, but there were real measurable consequences for harassment that were put into place. Can you kind of walk us through that and how that worked?
So it's not just the female farm workers who have come together. It's all the farm workers. The point is that it's the workers, the migrant workers, beginning in Florida and moving up through the southeast states, has faced appalling conditions in the fields. Sexual harassment itself comes into play every day. It's a very different working situation than an office, obviously. You're isolated in the fields. You're subject to crew leaders who say sexual favors are the price of a job. The way they've addressed this issue is several different ways. One is worker education that actually makes sure workers know what their rights are. It's a matter of comprehensive monitoring that includes not just audits, but a 24/7 hotline and protection from retribution. And when violations are seen to occur, there's real-world market sanctions. Either the person, the crew leader who may have committed this abuse, or the coworker is fired immediately, or if the grower does not come into compliance, they lose their market. That's 60% of the market for tomatoes, for example, are part of the Fair Food Program, and those buyers are not allowed to buy from any grower that's in violation of the standards. So it's a comprehensive approach that includes education, monitoring, and real-world market sanctions.
Well, that real-world market sanctions aspect is something that I'm really interested in. And David, I'm curious if you could weigh in on this. You know, we have also heard stories of sexual harassment at Ford. The New York Times did excellent reporting there. And there was a penalty involved, but a really small one when you're thinking about a giant company with huge market caps. So is there a way to take this Fair Food Program model and expand it to other industries, do you think?
I think it is, but I just don't know that it's very practical because you're going to get a lot of pushback. Everything comes back to how the investigation is done and how objectively the company goes through that process. Well, with that said, you know, I've been doing this 32 years, and I can tell you that if I go in on an investigation and find someone has been the source of harassment and has done so purposely, in my opinion, and for that matter also repeatedly, the recommendations to terminate. And, you know, more so when you take a look at cases where the person who was the harasser goes to court and claims some type of wrongful discharge, they lose those cases by an overwhelming majority. The courts have no tolerance for this kind of behavior. So, you know, companies need to look at this issue not in terms of the typical fear that they have regarding cases involving discrimination and wrongful discharge and fearing that they're going to be sued in those instances, and instead recognize that the best and easiest path is to fire people when they behave this way because it sends a message. And the message you send to everybody else when you keep people around and say, don't do this again, we're going to send you for training so that you don't do this in the future, is not the message that gets cultural change.
But don't you need a clear policy as to what you're not tolerating? I mean, Lily has written about this sort of myth of the bumbling male, which is, oh, gee, I didn't know that that hug was, you know, not welcome. I mean, how do we figure out the difference between, hey, Bob, don't do that, versus Bob, you've lost your job?
So I think that most employers look for sort of the rule book when they come to us and they ask us, you know, do you have a if-then statement that says if somebody does this, then we do that. And that just doesn't exist out there. So first step is for companies to go ahead and decide, okay, what is their culture going to be and how are they going to, at least going forward, handle these types of issues and mitigate them when they occur? Then the most important piece of that after is to be consistent. I mean, there's too many times where we'll go in and we'll talk to someone where the company has terminated immediately an individual in a lower level role for the same kind of behavior that they're about to do retraining for someone who's at a senior level role. You know, The head of sales tends to get away far more with the same kind of behavior that is not tolerated by someone who's working in the mailroom.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. We are talking about sexual harassment and workplace culture with Lily Loofborough, Susan Marquis, and David Lewis. Well, how did the two of you, Susan and Lily, who have thought about this, particularly when we were talking about power, that's the thing that David is talking about here, this differential treatment for a star versus your kind of regular coworker. How do we empower people who, because of race, income, you know, or even just kind of how supported they feel in a work environment, are at the lower end of a power differential?
The ways to get at this power aspect is to begin with recognizing the expertise of the women themselves, that the women have experience in the field, experience in their work situation. They have an expertise in the conditions that allow this behavior to occur. David's talked about the culture, and that's critical, but there's also physical conditions. We're talking about some of these restaurants. There's late night, post-shift activities, isolated storage rooms. The workers have seen the same things in the fields. If you can bring, we can ensure women have a place at the table where the company is making its policies. You have much better probability of coming up with successful solutions. They can say, it is in these conditions that this kind of behavior tends to occur, and those conditions can be addressed.
I want to put a spotlight, though, on the fact that what was just described is now happening in a lot of millennial-driven organizations as well. You're talking about in many of the tech firms and, again, millennial-driven populations, there's been a trend to go ahead and to turn these work environments into more fun environments. You're finding ping pong tables, foosball tables, pantries that actually have alcohol in them. And at 7 o'clock in the evening, the workplace looks more like the happy hour at a local bar than it does the workplace. And the one other alarming piece of around this particular issue is that a lot of those companies are also hiring HR people that are more oriented on attracting and retaining talent, not on handling these types of complex employee relations issues. So now they get into situations where you have harassment. harassment claims, which are being driven and fueled by the fact that there's an environment that's more like a bar than a workplace, and suddenly you've got things that are potentially spinning out of control. This isn't just about some of the, you know, blue-collar or service-oriented businesses. This is now very much a problem in corporate America.
Well, wait a minute, though,
if
because,
I could
yeah,
jump
Lily,
in.
I want you to hop in here because you're looking at this from really a 30,000-foot cultural standpoint. And one of those things is, okay, well, what is a modern workplace? What is it there for? Do we come close to victim blaming if we're saying, well, gosh, we were all at the Christmas party?
Right. I mean, I think it's instructive and significant that the initial wave of allegations actually came from the entertainment industry, where those distinctions actually are invisible. There's not necessarily an HR department in a lot of scenarios that would be able to respond to some of the concerns that came up. That said, I think we can learn a lot about what that kind of environment does and how it can change. And, you know, I think that one reason that we are seeing the beginning of the backlash that I've long been expecting to the Me Too moment, so to speak, is because we are seeing consequences being delivered piecemeal through what seems to amount to an inverse popularity contest in the entertainment industry. I do think, look, the public was needed to get this ball rolling, and now it's up to us to figure out what a good system should be. And I think we need a precise lexicon of unacceptable conduct. This is going to be slow, and it's going to be hard, and it's important that we be thoughtful and proceed with care.
Lily Loofborough is culture critic for The Week. Susan Marquis is the dean of the Pardee Rand Graduate School, and David Lewis, CEO of Operations Inc. and an HR consultant. Thank you all so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.